Support for this podcast comes from Microsoft Surface. Introducing Microsoft Surface Laptop Go. Available in three colors, its thin, light design, built-in HD camera, and touchscreen turns any space into your workspace. More at surface.com/laptopgo.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to the 730 Podcast, and I'm your host, Wally White. The reason we call this the 730 Podcast is because in the 90s hip-hop song Ebonics, the late, great Big L raps,
"If you 730, that mean you crazy."
Some might call me 730. I was recently hospitalized and diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and I'm trying to make sense of an issue, both for myself and my audience, that's too often misunderstood. I'm not a mental health expert, but I'm here to engage mental health professionals, athletes, artists, and other cultural influencers in conversations that explore how trauma and mental illness intersect with the Black experience. I recently sat down with Juliana Huxtable. She's a transgender artist and DJ whose artwork has been exhibited in some of the world's most renowned art institutions, including the Institute for Contemporary Arts in London, the New Museum, the Museum of Modern Art, and most recently, the Brooklyn Museum. She's also the author of Mucus in My Pineal Gland. She and I were classmates at Bard College and have known each other for close to 15 years. It was an absolute honor to sit down with her. We discussed the challenges she's endured with an intersex condition, her upbringing in Bible Belt, Texas, and African-American cultural norms adopted from slavery and how they've perpetuated generations of trauma. So we'll jump right in, as we always do, but from what I understand, you were brought up in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
What part of Texas did you grow up in?
Bryan/College Station, which are two small towns on the bigger end of the small town spectrum, but still small towns that together make up like a big small town. And so Bryan is the older town. Bryan has a long history. There's like slavery. There's a whole like segregated. It's very like Southern. College Station started as a train station to Texas A&M. And so that's where the town got its name. But together, they're like a weird entity. Texas, Southern, super conservative, you know, cowboy hats and truck balls, you know.
Right. You're like in the middle of like conservative Bible Belt America. And so you grew up there, but did your parents grow up there? Like, were your parents from Texas? Like, where did your parents come from?
My mom, well, she technically grew up in Gary, Indiana. But my family, my mom's side of the family is Alabama. They all kind of like, they were all, like, there's so many AGs in Alabama, but basically, I think during the Great Migration, like, they went up in clusters, and so it was, like, my grandfather and three of his brothers and my grandmother and one of her sisters and their, like, friend from, like, down the block would all, they kind of took over a chunk of Gary, and it was almost like an outpost from Alabama that was there, and so that's where my mom was from. But my roots, I would say I spent just as much time in Alabama as I did in Gary, because that's where my grandparents' house was, but, you know, all the reunions and stuff. And then my dad is from, his side of the family is from Kentucky and Ohio. Really Kentucky, but they live in Ohio now. But it's
like Cincinnati area?
Yeah, it's like Southern Ohio.
So your mom's from Gary, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you guys that don't know, Gary, Indiana is the home and birthplace of Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
Also, one of my favorite rappers is from Gary, Freddie Gibbs.
Yeah.
But yeah, Gary's like, from what I understand, it's a very deprived place, like from an economic standpoint.
Now it is. It's really, it's kind of sad. Like growing up as a kid, it was sort of like, we were like, oh, why do we have to go to grandma and grandpa's house? Like, it's just so sad. Like even as a kid, you're like, I don't want to be there. But I realized just from my mom and my aunts and uncles and everything, at one point it was kind of like a black mecca, you know, because there was the steel industry was booming and it was like people that, you know, were working like it more explicitly degrading and intense jobs in the South, like kind of created this whole world. And like seeing photos from when my mom and them grew up, I kind of get why people still hold on to Gary, but It's totally, now it's just like all of the houses are rotting from the inside out. It's like all of the forms of like, all of the ways that generally Black people in America are kind of discarded, it's so amplified in Gary. Like, I knew what a food desert was, like even in Brooklyn, like when I first moved there, I lived in a place where I was like, whoa, that's literally iceberg lettuce and like government cheese and tomatoes. Like I got that, but Gary was the first time where I was like, oh my God. It was like, this was for, I think, my grandmother's funeral. We went to the store because spiraling. I was like, I want to make a smoothie. And like, we went to the grocery store and it was just like, everything was powdered. Everything was that like juice drink, you know, like what I mean? Tang. Sips and like weird shit. It's like that, like when I say that to like a lot of people, they're like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, oh, I guess that's just like a Black people thing or something. But it's like no food that could provide you any sustenance. It was one of the darkest things I've ever seen. And like the water sucks. And like, it's really kind of extreme.
You said you grew up with your mom?
Yeah.
Was your dad in the picture at all?
He was, but he was like, my parents divorced when I was 8, and my dad is like a really cool person, and that's something that I've come to like respect, and like a lot of like my cultural interests, like sci-fi, and like, you know, he was like, what he was interested in and consumed by was really interesting. But as a father, he was really kind of not so good. And so, you know, he would come to like a piano, you know, the end of the year stuff. He would like come for certain things. And we would spend our summers with him and every other holiday with him. And so we saw him, but
he was in Texas?
No, he lived in New Jersey.
Oh, okay. So yeah. you actually would come to the Northeast
as
a kid.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. As a kid. At first, like I lived with just my dad when I was 8. I think the year that I was 8, maybe 8 into 9, I lived with my dad in Tuskegee, Alabama. Because, like, yeah, my mom was, there's a lot of, like, I think my dad actually has a lot of, like, mental health stuff that he needs to, like, work out. There's a lot of inherited trauma on both sides of my family. But, yeah, my mom is the one who raised me. Which is all to say my mom is the one who raised me. And my father was in the picture, but we also had a weird relationship. I had a weird relationship with both of my parents, but my mom, I kind of like, just because she was the one doing the raising, I always kind of just had like a certain amount of like respect that just couldn't go away. My dad, I was like, you're not really doing like the things that you should be coming through on. And so like, if you're going to be an asshole, I'm just going to be like, okay, go off. I guess we just don't need to fuck with each other then.
What did your parents do? What did they do professionally?
My dad was his area that he worked in was polymer engineering. And so we moved to College Station initially because he was a professor at A&M. And so he kind of, early on, he would bounce back and forth between kind of like teaching jobs and being like a professor of like engineering. And then he would go into the like corporate sector. And so he kind of bounced and forth between those two things. And my mom was like, basically like, worked in database engineering. And so she did a lot of like networking stuff, a lot of databasing stuff, like how to make like databases, the technology that allows databases to be accessible by the public and stuff like that. So they were both very like math, techie.
Type A.
Very type A. Totally unhinged, just like, we are Black America. You know, that's kind of how they got married. I feel like they probably were just like screaming at each other and just like pumping their fists or something.
Man.
But very type A.
Find that to be really interesting, especially considering the way in which you're sort of the trajectory you've taken. You've kind of gone in the complete opposite direction, yeah. You know? And I imagine that took a lot of courage in a lot of ways, just like kind of rejecting what your parents
said. Yeah.
You know, not rejecting it, but just taking a different path.
Taking space away from it. That's what, like, that's how I word it sometimes. I just need to take space away from that. Like, I mean, my dad, the thing about the one thing that was kind of cool about my dad, like he was really into sci-fi. He liked like erotic art. Like my dad was really sexually progressive. Like we like read The Joy of Sex when we were 12, and he was just like, here's like books on sex and like the G-spot or whatever. I mean, that came when we were a little bit older. But you know, and he read like Heavy Metal magazine and all of this like weird alien sci-fi porn. And I loved all of that stuff. And erotic fiction, erotic short fiction. He really liked collected shorts, and like I read so much of my dad's books and his comics, and so in a weird way, like he did influence me artistically in that sense. But generally speaking, they both were not about. They were like, "You're definitely not studying art." Just like, what is, like, even just to take the art class, I had to like lie to my mom. You know?
Art class at Bard.
At Bard, yeah. What? The art classes I took at Bard, because I was also taking econ classes, so I could say, "Oh, like I'm studying economics." Like, obviously, I don't want to study economics, but I just lied to them because they were both of a. There's a certain way that I think, especially like Black American, are taught to see education, and it's like you get an education to get a job. It's a feeder. It's like a direct feeder into getting a job. It doesn't make sense that you would study something that you might not make money, and then you should just like not go to school. And they were kind of like that. It's like, you know, and because they both worked in some form of engineering, education was like directly linked to like an industry, a job, you know, that's what education is for. And so it was a little bit foreign to them that I would want to study something that wasn't tied to a clear industry. And then that I would want to do something that just to them, they were like, you know, didn't get why I would do that. I don't think. Or didn't understand how I would support myself, and those questions kind of came first or were as important as what I was interested in or something.
And I read something on your experience at Bard, and I didn't realize that you had this experience, but you talk about your sort of exploration with studio art and painting and stuff and you know, the faculty at Bard saying you're like too trapped in your identity.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize you had that experience, but I was wondering like if you could speak to what that was like being at a, you know, Bard's a predominantly white institution, and suddenly having that sort of external, sort of basically like cutting you out or cutting you off. Like, what was that like?
It was like kind of shocking, and it felt really harsh in a way that wasn't really productive or conducive to me like growing. And I already found like, generally, Bard was a difficult experience because it's growing up in Texas. We were like middle class, totally fine. Like I thought, like, you know, shopping at Target, we're like legit bougie. You know what I mean? Because we go to Target every once in a while. So that's like, I'm thinking, oh, like we're totally like fine. This is what life is going to be like. And then you go to Bard, and it's so expensive. It was really hard for me financially to be there. My family has no inherited wealth. I was being raised by my mother. She was like, I don't know who you think is going to pay for this. This is really crazy. But like, you know, and so, but the arts are almost the most amplified version of that. It's like paints aren't included in your tuition. There's a studio fee every semester, like $700 just pops up out of nowhere.
And like, where does that money come
from? Why am I paying a studio fee? I pay fucking $45,000. In debt to be here, you know? And so it was already difficult in that sense. And it wasn't necessarily coming from like peers, although there was some of that, just because I think you're being around people that have like literally never talked to a Black person, like a lot of like, or had like a Black friend, or you know what I mean? Like, right. Like had one Black person, in, you know, in their class throughout all of high school or something. And so that energy, times the professors basically like reading me for just expressing myself, and they would any interest or kind of like question I had that was like related to what they perceived to be related only to my race was dismissed. And so I remember when we were learning about like the play between like light and shadow, and we were doing models, it was all like white models. And then we were supposed to do a self-portrait, and I felt like I didn't really know how to fully paint myself. I only knew how to like obsess over shadows as the starting point, but that doesn't really work. I was like, it doesn't work the same way. And then I ended up feeling like, now I look like Gumby. Like I can paint white people, but I can't do myself. This is really weird. And I would talk to my professors about that, and they would be like, you're obsessed with like your, you know what I mean? You need to like break out of this like racial obsession.
Although Juliana and I were part of different social groups at Bard, we shared the same experience as Black students on a predominantly white campus. Although we got what I think was a high-quality education, attending a college that many consider one of the most liberal and politically progressive in the country did not alleviate the intense scrutiny that we were under as students of color. This scrutiny was demonstrated in different ways. Although I never had a professor tell me that I was racially obsessed as Juliana had, I always felt as though I was under the microscope. One night during midterms, I left the Bard library. Shortly after midnight, I was wearing a Bard basketball hoodie and was minding my own business. And then it happened. I was approached by a Bard security guard. I said hello. His response, "Are you a student here?" I told him I was and frustratedly pointed at my hoodie. "Yes, I'm a student here." He was dumbfounded. He didn't ask me this question for any other reason other than my skin was brown. I can unequivocally say if I were white, I would have never experienced this. Blackness at a predominantly white institution like Bard is the elephant in the room. Most don't want to address or confront it. And when students of color put it on the table as a topic of discussion, they are often looked at as angry or racially obsessed, as Juliana put it. No, some whites are unwilling to confront their fragility surrounding conversations of race in a real and meaningful way. Instead, they become complicit in the promotion of systemic racism and its psychological effects on people of color, no matter how liberal they may be.
And I know that you talk about some of the stuff with your family, but I'm really curious to know, like, what your experience was like in school, coming up, primary school, middle school, high school, and how that, like, affected you psychologically, or did affect you psychologically? Yeah.
When I was really young, I really liked school, because the thing is like, below, when you're under a certain age, children aren't fully indoctrinated by their parents yet, and so you kind of just are what you are. And so there was like, there's a lot of just like, you know, it's like kids will be like, "Are you a girl or are you a boy?" But you can just be like, "I'm a girl," and they're like, "Okay." You know what I mean? It's not like a thing. It's not racism, dogmatic system in place for them to like not just like go with that. And so when I was really young, I was like almost kind of excelled socially. I was like kind of, you know, like kind of popular, and you know, it was like really fun. I would say up until like second or third grade. But then it started to get more intense. I mean, I was bullied, but I was generally really strong. I already stood out being black in so many contexts that I was in, like, you know. And I think one advantage of coming up in a family that's as harsh as, that's, can be, that's as, like, hardline as mine, is that you have tough skin. Like, I thought about suicide a lot, but it's like, just dealing with, like, my mom being so intense and all of her, like, you know, like the abusive stuff that I grew up with. So it's almost like when you've dealt with so much mental, physical, verbal abuse, but also just like intensity, I don't think I actually would have killed. It would have taken like a lot for me to actually kill myself, but I thought about it. But
did you feel supported? Like, how were you being supported through, like, some of the bullying you're talking about? Like, did your family support
it? I wasn't being supported. I, like, didn't even really... Because it started off kind of small. Like, you know, second grade, it was there, but it wasn't crazy. Really is when the bullying started to get hectic was when puberty started. It's, like, 11, 12. And some of it, like, at that age wasn't even bullying. It was just, like, weird, really weird shit from, like boys. Because my mom was always, like... You need to hang out with us girls. You need to hang out with more boys. And so she would send me to, like, you know, it would be like, okay, all of the, like, black boys from my school, from my church or whatever, and, like, the Associated Network, they would have a sleepover. And she would be like, you have to go to the sleepover. And really weird shit would happen. Like, people would chase me around, and then everyone would, like, jerk off on me. You know, like, weird, like, stuff that everyone knows happens. But it's like, I got a lot of that sort of things, a lot of like misdirected sexual attention because my body was also weird, and then you're putting someone that already has an androgynous body and is already really girly in a room with a bunch of boys. That is not probably going to turn out so well. And so in a lot of those circumstances, it wasn't even bullying, it was weird sexual shit, like me and like violence, like weird sexual violence, collective sexual violence. And it was like, you know, it never got to the point where I was like, have crazy PTSD or something. But that was like, there was a lot of that happening at that age. And then high school was insane. High school was like warfare. Like, people would say, people would threaten to kill me all the time. People would call me insane shit all the time. People would throw really hard and violently throw things at me all the time. There were hallways that I could not go down. People would chase me down the streets in cars with pickup trucks, with guns. People would terrorize me. I would go running. People knew I would run. They would like throw water balloons with like piss at me. It was really intense, especially early high school, like ninth grade year and 10th grade year was like, whoa. I never really let that like, totally. It didn't make me, it just made me more emboldened in certain ways. Like, I knew I was smarter than, like, everyone at my school. I was just like, whatever. Like, and it took me a while to realize that. But I did debate in high school, and my debate coach was, like, kind of like my second mom. And I loved the debate team. And, like, debate kind of became a way for me to understand, like, oh, like, I need to stop second-guessing myself. And I kind of, once I got on the track of, like, I'm actually just, like, smarter than all of you people, and I just need to go to school, I kind of knew. I was like, once I go to school, it's lit. Yeah. You know what I mean? I obviously still worked through stuff in college, and it's not like I, you know, left high school and everything was wonderful. But generally speaking, I had enough of a perspective in high school to know I'm going to get out of here. And even though there were a lot of times that I feared for my life, it never got to that place. It never got to that place. And by the time I was in high school, even though I had like a really sporadic sense of self-worth, it didn't get to... My most intense phase for suicide, the suicidal thoughts, really, really extreme depression was probably like started at 11. I was also dealing with like, that's, it was also like a lot of like physical abuse in my house from my mom. And she was having like, my mom's like bipolar schizophrenic and like was just like not dealing with it, not treating it. Also, she had really intense like PPD. When she was, but then like she would have episodes that were specifically tied to what was happening during her PPD. It was like a lot also happening during that time period. And so it was hard for me to separate like what was primarily depression and kind of like self-worth issues tied to gender and stuff that was also just kind of coming at me because I was growing up in a really crazy household. My dad was being really hectic. You know, the divorce was intense. Like, there was a lot coming at me.
According to the National Alliance for Mental Illness, lesbian, gay, and bisexual adults are 2 times more likely to experience mental health conditions than heterosexual adults. 48% of all transgender adults reported considering suicide in the last year. And high school students who identify as part of the LGBTQ community are 5 times more likely to commit suicide. In fact, Nigel Shelby, a gay high school student in Huntsville, Alabama, committed suicide earlier this year after being bullied because of his sexuality. Although there's been progress and Americans are more tolerant to differences in sexual preference than they've ever been, progress is still needed in our collective awareness of the correlation between members of the LGBTQ community and mental health conditions. America is in the midst of a crisis. Violence against people who identify as trans has become quite alarming. According to the Human Rights Campaign, 10 trans people were murdered in Louisiana since 2013. Chicago saw 7 deaths, and Jacksonville had 3 last year. One of the most notable deaths happened in the spring, when a trans woman named Malaysia Booker was murdered. Sadly, she was one of 3 murders of black trans people in Dallas this year. Anti-trans violence, especially against blacks, is a serious problem in our country, and it's really, really important that we become allies for all people who identify as trans, regardless of their race.
Was there any point, you know, and I've done a lot of therapy, so that's kind of... The next thing I'm asking, was there any point in which you were getting therapy? Like, did you seek it out? Like, what role has therapy played in your life, if any?
The first therapist I went to was divorce therapy. I don't know if that was like formally part. I feel like it was probably formally part of my parents' divorce thing, but we went to, when we were with my dad in New Jersey, we would go see a divorce counselor. And then I saw the counselor when I was depressed and having like body issues. Then I sought therapy then. And that was the first time that I think therapy was beneficial, even though I don't think she really knew what to do with the situation. I don't necessarily blame her for that. If anything, I put more blame on the doctor for being, you know. But after that, I went to therapy off and on when I was in college, but never really. And then I moved to New York, and I've had, like, I'll go to therapy for a period of time. Like, recently, I've been like, oh, I should go back to therapy again. And then also with my mom, basically, because, like, you know, I would call on Christmas, you know, whatever, say, hey, but, like, I really didn't talk to my family. I didn't see a lot of my family, not all of my family, but I didn't. For a while.
Because like, they sort of ostracized you, or just because you kind of like pulled back?
They did everything. It's like they see, like they would probably choose to see it as like I just ran away, but being around them was just at times just like I felt unbearable. You know, it was a lot of unwillingness to budge. It was a lot of refusal to take anything that I was like asking of them seriously. And on my mom's side, people are just conservative. They're just like, we are how we are. I don't know what that is. Like, I don't know what you run up in here telling us. Like, you know, they might say something on TV, but when you come around here, you know what? It was very that attitude. Just like, when you come around here, like, I ain't calling you no, fucking Juliana. And it was just like, you're spiraling. You're really, really, really spiraling right now. And I just didn't want to deal with it. And they were like, so intense and just like policing of everything. And everything was like, I'm a drug addict and I'm gonna like die of AIDS. And, you know, God created like men to be men and women to be women. And like, just, it was like nonstop. And I just didn't want to do it. I was like, I'm not dealing with this anymore. Why would I do this? This isn't making me feel good. I don't feel loved. I actually leave feeling. And when I had lived in New York, even just that first 6 months in New York, because that was when I was supposed to go to, like, I don't know, I think it was like Gary or Texas or Alabama for Christmas with my mom's side of the family. And I literally started panicking. And I was with my friends because I just like loved being in New York. I was just like, oh, this is amazing. I could just do me. Nobody gives a fuck. It's not even about being like in your face. I was just like, just let me do me. I'm not trying to like change anyone's opinion of anything. I couldn't give a fuck what you think about me. I just want to do me. And I was supposed to go, and I felt like I was doing that, and I was supposed to go back for Christmas, and I just started freaking out and panicking. My friends were in my room, and I started crying, and I was like breathing weird, and I was like, and I didn't want to go. I was just like, I don't want to go, and I started bawling, and then I started changing my clothes, and I was just like, oh, what happens if I show up like this? They're going to like freak out. It turned into this whole ordeal, and my friends were like, whoa, what the, like, this is, I don't think you should be going if this is how this makes you feel. And I got on the train to go to JFK or whatever. And then I just got off the train and walked to the other side of the track. And I called my friends and I was like, I'm just going to do Christmas here. And this was like 1 or 2 days before Christmas. And so I just texted all my friends that were in town. And we had Christmas and it was actually really great. And I've had Christmas in New York ever since then, even though I talked to like, I'm on good terms with most of my family.
What was your family's response to you not showing up? Did they have, like...
My extended family, my aunts and uncles, I was like, and my grandparents, I was like, I honestly can't even deal with, like, them. Like, I didn't even... I was like, I'm not even going to process, like, what they think about the situation. My mom was sort of, like, the person that I really wanted. And so I didn't know how to express it because growing up, you don't like, you know, a lot of people don't understand. And this has followed me to this day. Sometimes I have like difficulty just like going to the thing or like, especially if there's any vague inclination of authority or kinship, I find it hard just to be like, no, this is how I feel. You know what I mean? And with the growing up, you didn't express how you felt. It was never a space for you to do that. My mom is like hardline. It's yes, ma'am. It's no, ma'am. Yeah, I did tell you to do that and expect you to do that now. Sasha, you're just going to do it now, because if not, I'm going to beat you or do something really intense and crunk that no child wants to deal with. And so how do you then, after years of that, no room for challenging, no room for even a joke or just like any kind of fluid exchange. Now I'm supposed to just like, we're supposed to just hang out and I'm supposed to tell you like about my life. I didn't know how to do it. So I wrote her a letter. I wrote her this really, really, really like long, not really, really, really long, but like it was a long, really heartfelt letter. And I was like, this is how I wanted to express it. And basically the initial response was like, you didn't say it to my face. You know, you can write what you want in the letter, but you ain't cut. Yeah. And I was just like, what is this thing? Why are y'all like this? Like, this is your child pouring themselves. I'm really trying to be as honest with you as I can. And I talked about in the letter, I was just like, there's a lot of intense abuse in the family that has been handed down. We are straight from slaves. The way people are beat off switches and kids are bleeding and you're punching kids and you're just like slapping kids on their backs with butt. It's like really crazy Pasolini film level slave shit. And it's I can't pretend like this isn't happening. I'm not going to just like pretend like this isn't happening. And I got it the most intense because you all always thought that something was wrong with my gender expression or my body. And you policed that through disciplinary methods inherited straight from slavery. And I think that's really crunk. And if you want to talk about that, let's talk. But like, that's why I don't want to hop on a plane and just like sit there in silence, like whatever. Do I want to eat grandpa's food? Yeah. But I'm like not going to deal with all of this. Just for that, that's not worth it to me.
There's so much in that you share that I was like getting crazy flashbacks of my mom beating me with a telephone wire.
Yeah.
Like the old, like I have these welts on my skin.
Yes, you would be covered. Like my grandparents, the cruelest thing they would do is they would be like, and my mom's parents were the most intense. My dad's parents didn't really like, maybe they would lightly spank you, but they weren't really. But his family is more, it's a different class situation. You know what I mean? It's like my grandparents on that side went to college, but my mom's parents, it's like, if you did something wrong, you were brought out as a child to the tree and they were like, pick a switch. Obviously, any child in complete and abject, just like fear and terror, is not going to pick the one that's going to hurt them the most. It would not be in their interest. And no child, no matter how many times you put them in that scenario, is going to choose the thing that's going to hurt them most. It does not make sense. And so you would always pick one or a medium one. And then they would like test on their arm and they would break it on their arm. If the switch broke, that meant you were getting beaten double for trying to get out of punishment by picking a weaker switch. And they would take off a branch fully with leaves and rip it through their fingers like this and just go off. And it was the most painful thing you've ever seen. And you're just like crying out and they just like kept doing it. And it was like, do you hate me?
Yeah.
I actually feel like you hate me. And you're just covered in goosebumps and you're sobbing. And there's like blood coming from like welts on your thighs or your back. And I was like, this is crazy. Anything was better than get. It's just like it never. But it did get to a point. Like, this is one thing in my household. What was interesting is that, like, that was kind of the sign that you've become an adult, which I also just think is directly tied to slavery. When there's no amount of pain that could be inflicted on you that would make you flinch. And that's, we were all like that. That's how you got to a point. And there were certain men that could still do it. Like, I had my cousin-in-law, you know, he had all sorts of crazy stuff that he must have gone to, but you know, we would all just get beat for no reason. All the kids would be called in. And I had another, that was common in my family, like performative beating of children. It's like, get in here. All the kids get called in there. And then it would be like, we would be like, we didn't do anything. What's going on? They're like, you were about to do something. You're just worthy of being beaten. And that's kind of what you were raised to think, is that I, at any given point, am fucking up enough to deserve being humiliated by someone that I love or I think that loves me, and in front of people and publicly.
Right.
It was really, I just like, I don't understand that. And now as an adult, I'm like, I mean, I guess, but I grew up in that. I'm like, I don't feel that way about that. I would never beat. I felt that way even at the time. I would never beat people, kids like that. And so it does take a certain amount of checking out to even get to that point.
Far too often, slavery and its psychological effects are simplified or dumbed down to the mere mistreatment of Black folks. However, the issue of slavery is far more complex than that. Slavery not only came with deep-rooted racism and white supremacy that still exists, but it also came with a conditioning that made it normal and okay to inflict pain on Black children. Almost all of my friends got their ass beat as kids. It was the norm. Shit, I can still feel ass whoopings my pops gave me as a child. We all carry some form of PTSD from this shit, whether we know it or not.
You mentioned having an intersex condition.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, like, how you understood that growing up, and like what the conversations were around that. Mm-hmm. Were there conversations, and then like how that affected you psychologically?
The conversations were constantly changing because I think with my family and me, so much of a lot of the difficulty was just in like having like a language to talk about things. And so growing up, everyone was just like, you know, I was like really effeminate. I thought I was a girl, whatever. But everyone was just like, oh, you're like really artsy and like creative and whatever. And like certain family members were like, are not at all surprised, or they don't pretend to be surprised by me now. You know, some people like to act brand new. But it was like, you know, so when you're young, it's kind of like sort of tolerated. Like people like I was disciplined for like acting too feminine a lot. But then when I hit puberty, basically what happened is that then what was already kind of a taboo gender performance then became literally embodied. And so like there was all of this stuff in my family when my boobs, when I was like 11, I started growing, like, and it was like actual breasts and hips, and no one really wanted to acknowledge that. And I was really self-conscious about it. And people in my family would be like, you need to do more push-ups. And they would like make me work out in front of them and do all this, which only kind of makes that more visible. It doesn't make it go away, you know? And so at a certain point, I was really depressed. And my mom took me to like a psychiatrist who was just like, your child is like totally depressed, and a lot of it is related to body stuff. And so at the time, they thought that the best solution, I still didn't really know anything about the intersex thing at this time. I just think like, oh, I have an androgynous body, and it's just like, so, oh, maybe it's like a hormonal thing, I don't know. And so they were going to give me surgery, and so I was going to get surgery to remove my breast tissue, and they were going to put me on testosterone and or some sort of steroid or something.
And the psychiatrist was going to...
The psychiatrist was working with a doctor in my hometown. Oh, okay. So it was like the psychiatrist was like, I don't know exactly what to do, but like whatever, like maybe we should consult a doctor. So a doctor was consulted, and the doctor, generally just being kind of conservative, is like, well, technically, you know, they're like, well, you have a penis, so that means that you should probably just be a boy, so we're just going to go in that direction. So you should get surgery, and then we'll give you testosterone or something, because I didn't grow muscles, and like it's the things that happen to boys in puberty weren't happening to me.
Especially in Texas, where they feed them like...
Right.
No, sometimes as an athlete, I look at athletes from Texas sometimes. I'm like, what the hell are they feeding those kids?
No, they're like water buffaloes. It's really insane. But basically, in the state of Texas, and I've never talked to my dad. This is one thing I kind of want to talk to him about. I think he was also doing it for weird, selfish reasons, but... In the state of Texas, if you're getting, if someone who's a minor who has divorced parents is undergoing something that requires that one parent act on behalf of the minor as if they were an adult, the other parent can question that parent's like sanity or soundness as like a custodian of that child. And so my dad basically did that to my mom for the surgery. And so that's why I didn't end up having the surgery, because he challenged that. He had used his like parental rights to challenge that. then he kind of also did a weird thing where it's like, you should be working out more. This is a cop out. At least that's how he expressed it to me. Part of me wants to think, well, maybe he had a slightly more progressive agenda and just didn't want me to like do something that obviously didn't fit my personality. I don't know, but I'm thankful that that happened either way, because I didn't get that surgery and I never was put on
testosterone
or weird steroids so that I would grow muscles, like whatever the fuck crazy shit they were gonna do. And so it wasn't until college that I really started to like find out more on my own that I knew that I should get tested for Klinefelter's. And that's when I did that. I just like went to a doctor and asked them to do the test, and then I found out that I have Klinefelter's.
And for our audience that doesn't know what Klinefelter's are,
it's an extra one or more extra X chromosomes, and it's a form of intersex where there's like a range of like what that, how that can turn out physically, but a lot of people, generally you're taller, you have slender shoulders, you don't gain a lot of muscle mass, you have like wider hips, breast development, usually you're infertile, you know what I mean? There's all sorts of steroids and stuff that you can do, but there's a lot of like trans, specifically a lot of trans women end up having that condition also. And so a lot of like tall trans people that end up modeling have that condition, which I think is kind of funny. Cause I found out more, you know, as I've learned more about like all of this, like what it means and other people who have conditions and what goes on. And so that's kind of, but it's a weird form of intersex because it's not like you're born with like genitals that read as between the two.
Right.
You are born and everyone just assumes that you're normal. They don't ask any questions. And then you hit puberty and it's like, what's going on? And, you know, and so it's a bizarre form of gender things. And so my family, it was really hard. They didn't really know what to do. They were just like, you know, work out, eat more. And it's like, what? That's not a solution to any of this, but go off. And they were kind of cool because then it became, they chose to ignore the body stuff. And they were like, okay, we're just going to set all of the body stuff aside and blame you for all of your gender ambiguity. And then now what we're going to do is just be like, okay, well, we're going to treat you as gay, which is a sin, and you should go to hell. Because it's actually easier for us as a family to deal with, even the one people that we're accepting, it was easier for them just to be like, oh, you're just a gay male. That doesn't challenge their ideas of gender. Being intersex, they're just like, almost it's like they didn't want to acknowledge it. But then on the other hand, for people that are kind of conservative, sometimes that gives them, they're like, oh, well, it's justified now. You know what I mean? And right. It's a weird way where they're like, oh, well, you have a medical reason. So that's different than just nilly willy just being out here. You know what I'm saying? Saying that you want to be a woman or something. It's very, you know how black people are. And like, and so it was weird and dealing with, and I'm still like, I just went back to Texas, maybe 3 weeks ago, a month ago. And I still talk about this stuff. Like I was hanging out with my cousin Shay Shay. And it was funny because my boyfriend was there and he was like meeting my family for the first time in my family. I was just like, you know, if you know me, like people who know me, they know I'm really black, but my family is like nigga shit. You know what I mean? It's like, nah. It's not like
nothing subdued.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so, but we talk about all of that. We talked about all of the like weird body stuff, and I found out things about like what, you know, other family members thought of me or why they were conservative, and you know. And so it's all now, but now it's kind of cool. I feel like with my cousins especially, generally I really like my generation of my family it's just like leaps and bounds in terms of like, it's like we just have a conversation and I explain my experience, and the next time it's like, oh, obviously, duh, that's totally about. And it's just like we really fuck with each other, and both on my mom's side and on my dad's side, except for one cousin on my mom's side who like is like whatever, like man spiraling, and is, yeah, he's really, 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 really conservative, but can also be really misogynistic, whatever. I hope at some point maybe we can chill, but I'm not really pressed about it either way.
Okay, mm-hmm. So you guys go to this psychiatrist, you go to this doctor.
Mm-hmm.
These conversations are being had. At any point, what role did you play in the conversations, or did you play any role in the conversations? These people were just making decisions for you?
I didn't really feel at the time, like, I just kind of went with, like, for the, for example, the psychiatrist, it just felt good to that someone listened to me and that I felt genuinely heard by her, whatever. She's, like, kind of Christian and well-meaning, so she's recommending things that are sort of hectic, but it just felt good to be heard by her. And so I just sort of went with, and with my mom, it's like, you know, it's a Southern family. There wasn't really room for me to be like...
To question
what's being presented as the proper track.
Right.
You, that just wouldn't really
That's just a
happen.
That's a Black thing, too. Yeah. But I think in the South, it's like, it's intensified, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's a Black thing. I vividly remember, like, asking my parents things as a kid, and it'd be the quintessential response I would get was, because I said so, like,
yeah,
you know,
just, literally, and it's just like, it's not a reason, I'm
right, so it just okay. made me as a kid questioning things, like I had to be very selective with like
yeah.
what I wanted to be like
yeah.
mommy, can we, like, no, like, you know, it was like a quick yeah. heavy hitter response. So that's crazy.
I feel like sometimes in those circumstances, especially for families that like want you to like get to school, it's like just generally asserting yourself as a Black person is seen as a risk. And so you're kind of just trained to like acquiesce, like work really hard, but like sort of just like acquiesce. Like that's what you're taught to do. And then like if the shit really hits the fan, obviously pop off like with like fighting. Like in my family, you were weirdly like... Like, if I got a referral or expelled from school for getting in a fight, as long as I won the fight, it was like, okay, fine. It's like, what? You know, it's like, in certain ways, it's encouraged for you to, like, go off, but it was not encouraged to question authority, experts, institutions, you know.
Right, you had to, like, kind of fit in line and just sort of
right.
go along with the flow. I'm really fascinated by the body aspects of your sort of upbringing and sort of how that intersects with your art. Because
mm-hmm.
so much of your art is very much body-based,
mm-hmm.
both in terms of the visual art and some of the written stuff you've
mm-hmm.
done in your book. And so I was wondering, like, what's the inspiration behind that? Obviously,
mm-hmm.
there's your experience, but do you have another agenda with what you're doing
mm-hmm.
with the artwork in regard to the body? Because it's such a central theme in the stuff that you're doing.
I guess it's using the idea from what's interesting for me to use the idea of a body or the body or my body as a way of like undoing that or something. Like, I think for so long I dealt with policing, obsession with kind of categorization and definitions, and it was always trying to adhere to a really set notion of what a body was or wasn't or could not be. And so I think a lot of my work is finding a space of like play and kind of like exploration that liberates what a body is or isn't or what it can or can't do, because I think that I'm as obsessed with bodies as I also am just like totally over them and annoyed by them, but I'm like tethered to it. And so it's like, I want to explode it in as many different directions as I can. And so, you know, and that's why like, I love thinking about the interaction, like technology is an extension of the body, or like modification of DNA, or like representations of half humans, half animal. Like it's all kind of I think it's like a sort of chaotic outward movement in terms of thinking about what a body is and like how I want to depict it or whatever.
Yeah, I know the 3D sculpture that Frank Benson
yeah.
did of you. I looked at that and all I could think of was the whole idea of being trans.
Yeah.
And how that piece is just such an in your face piece. Like,
yeah.
This is what trans is.
Like, yeah.
And you like, I think as a viewer, you almost have to make a instinctive decision on like what your viewpoint is
yeah,
of this,
yeah.
just looking at it. You
yeah.
know? And I think that's such a powerful thing, because it's forcing people to have conversations,
yeah.
even if it's not with other people, but with themselves. But
yeah.
like, how do I really feel about this? You know?
Right.
And I thought that piece is really powerful in that sense. So you're doing the poetry, you're doing the art, but you're also a DJ.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that kind of fit into like your whole persona and, you know?
Well, it started kind of everything I do pretty much started organically. Like, I've always loved nightlife, loved going out, I threw parties at Bard, you know, that already started. I've always loved being like that. I think Bard was probably when me throwing parties started. I maybe had like two house parties in college, but with my mom, it was like, my friends are over and I'm like making them wipe off when they're there just because like if she came over and anything was off, it would be crazy. So I've always loved nightlife. I love to dance. I love clubs. I love just like being out in the night. I think it's a fun, generative, interesting space that, you know, you meet like so many, most of my friends I've met, you know, usually at night. So DJing, I was hosting parties, and I was an obsessive consumer of dance music and mixes. And so, and I would write up, and I had my blog, and I would write about mixes that people released. And so then other DJs, like all the people, the producers and DJs that I looked up to would find me because I would be writing about them online. And so I was kind of felt like a part of a thing, but I was just hosting parties and would go off and dance really hard and was like a fan. And so it wasn't so crazy that I would end up doing it myself. It was like, I was organizing a magazine launch party. This magazine my friend was editing. And they asked me to throw the party, and I was excited to do it. The budget they gave me, based on how much I thought people should get paid, I couldn't really afford an opening DJ or act or something. And so I was like, oh, I'll just play music for the opening. And then people were coming up to me and trying to hire me for gigs. And I was like, oh, wow.
I know we have to wrap up. So I just wanted to thank you for coming out and like sharing your whole, you know, everything. Like I learned so much more about you today that I didn't know. I feel really inspired by what you do, like your story, all that stuff. And I just really, really am thankful that I was able to, you know, rap with you today for this episode. So yeah, thank you so much.
We out here.
My conversation with Juliana was really enlightening. She's clearly a brilliant mind with a soul as rich as gold. But she's dynamic and uncompromising, too. A true trailblazer. I consider myself to be pretty progressive when it comes to issues confronting the LGBTQ community. But she really opened my eyes and mind to what it's like to live in that world. Despite the drawbacks and scrutiny, her courage and commitment to being herself, or doing her as she put it, should be an inspiration for us all. All right, y'all, before we wrap up this episode, I just want to share a couple resources with you all. You know, my conversation with Juliana really opened my mind a little bit more so to the issues surrounding mental health and the LGBTQ community, and how there's a real need for us to sort of share resources and sort of educate one another on a lot of these issues. So the first resource that I found was the Trevor Project. They offer a bunch of different services, but among them are they have a 24-hour toll-free hotline. That hotline, the number is 866-488-7386. And that's just for like if you're having issues or you really conflicted by some things emotionally, you can call that hotline. Also, there's an online social network for youth ages 13 to 24. And they also offer some educational programs for schools. So for any of my fellow educators out there, I'll definitely look into the Trevor Project. They might have some resources and programming that could be of use for you within your school. So check out the Trevor Project. There's also the LGBTQ and Peer Listening Helpline. And that's essentially just a hotline for you to call, tap into, you know, get some resources, maybe some referrals. Also just maybe share, you know, some of the, you know, emotional distress or things that you're confronted by. That hotline is 888
340-4528. I would definitely tap into both these resources. If you need any of my people out there in the LGBTQ community, know that you have an ally in the 730 podcast. And yeah, we just want to continue to further the dialogue and bring community to all spaces and all people that are feeling subject to some form of oppression in our country. So, all right, that's all for this episode. We want to thank Juliana for coming out. She's a real dynamic soul, and I want to just, you know, thank her for being so generous with her time. I know she's been traveling across the world this summer doing different DJ shows, art shows, and things like that. So the fact that she was willing to come out, I just, you know, I'm very, very grateful for that. And that conversation was just really rich and powerful in its own ways. Yeah, we just want to thank Juliana, and that's all for 7:30 on this episode. So be on the lookout for episode 3. We're coming. We're going to keep bringing the heat, and that's all.